Who in here has heard of ocean acidification? So that's fantastic, because we just did some polling at NOAA, and the national average is about 8% of the people in the United States have heard of ocean acidification, which is just absolutely terrible, and about 90% of the people in this room raised their hand. So as usual, Sitka's ahead of the curve in terms of everything environmental and progressive in terms of the way you're thinking about the environment and the way the impact, the way environmental climate change is going to impact our lives. So I know you heard some talks yesterday starting to introduce this idea of climate change and the impact of climate change on humans, and I'm going to follow up with that today, specifically talking about ocean acidification, but I'm also going to lean a little bit more into the multi-stressor world, where we think about ocean acidification as one stressor, but then there are also a few other things that are also going to exacerbate the impacts of ocean acidification through other means, and we'll talk about those as we go along. And so I want to identify, it was too many people to list, but there's literally hundreds of scientists' work that have gone into what I'm going to show you today, and the absolute intense effort that they put into it. So as we go through, I'll try to identify them as best I can. So if we want to talk about ocean acidification, we have to first talk about carbon dioxide. Over the past 250 years, really since the Industrial Revolution, carbon dioxide has been going up in the atmosphere, where we can really see over the recent sort of decade, we really start to see sharp increases in carbon dioxide. And so what I've plotted for you here, the red is carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere measured at Mauna Loa in Hawaii, and the black is the average. And so you see how the red goes up and down, and this is literally the planet breathing every year. When the northern hemisphere goes into summer, and all our vegetation grows in the northern hemisphere where most of the land is, there's a big uptake of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, which causes it to go down. And then when winter time comes in the northern hemisphere and that sink goes away, because most of the southern hemisphere is just ocean, the CO2 levels go up. And so we see this natural breathing of the planet, but then if we overlay the average concentration on top of that, we see this very definitive trend where just since 2004, carbon dioxide has gone from 376 parts per million up to about 388, and where we are today, we're at about 392. We just haven't updated the graph yet. So not only is carbon dioxide increasing in the atmosphere, but the rate of which it is increasing is also going up. So you can see since the year 2000, we can see a pretty significant increase from about accumulation of about 1.2 parts per million per year to now, in 2011, we're at about 2.3 parts per million a year. And we can really see this on a decadal time scale. If you look in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, you see this slowly starting to tick up. And now from 2000 to 2010, we're at 2.1 parts per million per year. So every year, on average, we had 2.1 parts per million of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. And so where is all that CO2 going? Well, if we add it up, our two major sources of carbon dioxide are fossil fuel burning, which contributes about 7.5 petagrams of carbon per year, and then also changes in land use practices. And this is the part of it that a lot of people don't think about, is that when we cut down forests, when we cut down trees, those trees are naturally taking up carbon dioxide, but once they're removed, they're not able to do that anymore. So anytime we see urbanization or deforestation that removes that land sink for CO2, we have to add that into the amount that we think of as humans contributing. And so total, we're putting about 9 petagrams of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year. And I broke this down for you just to give you some idea of scale. 1 petagram is about 22 trillion pounds. So that gives you some perspective. And that's this 9 petagrams that we emit every year is the equivalent of 99 billion small cars that we put into the atmosphere every year in terms of fossil fuel burning. And so where does that go? Well, about 46% of it ends up in the atmosphere and is retained in the atmosphere, and that's what gives us our warming signal that we see. That's why the Earth is warming up. Another 30% ends up on land, so this is taken up by plant matter and trees and forest. And then the last part of it that we're most concerned about for this talk anyway, this 26% or 2.3 petagrams is taken up by the ocean. And that's what's driving this big change that we see in seawater chemistry. And so this is a little schematic showing you what's going on with ocean acidification and why the ocean is becoming more acidic. As this carbon is added into the ocean, it reacts very quickly with water to form this carbonic acid, this very weak acid that then breaks down into two components, bicarbonate and carbonate. And this carbonate, taking this carbonate out of solution, removes, this is what the shell-building organisms use to form their shell. So any calcifying organism, a crab or a clam, anything in the ocean that builds a shell, needs this carbonate material in order to calcify. And so for every CO2 molecule you add to the ocean, you lose one molecule of carbonate ion, which is critical to shell building and growth. And on top of that, you produce two hydrogen ions. And if you remember what the definition of pH is, pH is just the concentration of the hydrogen ion in solution. And so for every one molecule of CO2 you put in the ocean, you get two hydrogen ions out. And so as that hydrogen ion concentration increases, the pH goes down and the ocean becomes more acidic. So we're concerned with these two things, the fact that pH is reduced and that carbon ion concentrations are going down. And so we can see over the past 25 million years, which is this is starting at present day, going back 25 million years into the past, the ocean pH has stayed pretty constant. It varies between about 8.05 all the way up to 8.3 or a little over 8.3 during this time period. But you can see it stays pretty much between 8.1 and 8.2 for most of this time over the past 25 million years. But then you see what happens. The Industrial Revolution hits, and we can see starting in 1800 where pH was, where we were in 2000, and this is based on some very, very conservative carbon dioxide emission scenarios. This is probably even unrealistic now today of where we will be in 2050 in the year 2100. And so if we burn CO2, even on conservative estimates, we're going to be well outside of this range of pH that the oceans experience over this time frame. And we know that from actual observations that we're making. And so what I have plotted here for you is the top panel. This is carbon dioxide in parts per million from the year 1985 going forward to 2010, and then pH down here on the bottom over the same time scale. And we've made these measurements at three time series sites in the ocean, one in the Pacific Ocean just off of Hawaii, one in the Atlantic Ocean off of Bermuda, and then another one over near just off of North Africa. And you can see these very definitive trends where carbon dioxide, CO2 in the ocean is definitely going up at all three sites, and at all three sites, pH is going down. And so we know this is occurring, and it's occurring fast enough for us to actually measure it in real time. And so where are we headed? Again, starting in 1850, basically the Industrial Revolution, this has been the trend line, this black line of what's happened to CO2 over that 250 or so years. And so this is where we are today. And these two, this blue line and this red line, are two different carbon dioxide emission scenarios based on IPCC reports. And so you can see this is where we were hoping for 20 years ago when we were talking about Kyoto, when we were talking about some really aggressive CO2 mitigation strategies. We were hoping we could be at this RCP 2.6, which would have stabilized pH in the ocean. We would have still been lower than what we were at the Industrial Revolution, but it wouldn't have been so bad. In actuality, it looks like we're headed for one of the worst-case scenarios in the IPCC scenarios, where we continue to emit CO2 at an increasing rate, and we wind up by the year 2100 by another 0.42 reduction in pH, and that's going to put us down here less than a pH of less than 7.8, which is really, really startling if you think about the rate of change, how quickly that has happened. And that's really the problem, is because if you look over the geological record, now we're going back 250 million years, so 10 times longer than what we saw at that previous slide, and you can see that there are times during the Earth's history when pH has gotten down to these lower levels. And unfortunately, one of those times just happens to be the mass extinction event of the dinosaurs. And so we know we're pretty certain that the dinosaurs weren't burning carbon weren't emitting carbon dioxide. But there were other changes going on, and during this time, we saw that the planet warmed up considerably. There was an extreme acidification event where pH got very low, and we also saw a lot of deoxygenization, and that's going to be one of the other things I talk about. One of the other stressors is that how low the oxygen concentrations got and how we're seeing declines in oxygen today in our ocean. But if we go back to the historical perspective, we see that 55 million years ago, right at the mass extinction of the dinosaurs, we see that in the ocean, what this is a sediment core. You go down, you drill a sediment core, and what it shows you is layer by layer of what was happening in the ocean in each year. And so you see up and through this millions and millions of years here, this fraction up at the top is the weight percent of calcium carbonate in the sediment. So this means you had a lot of calcification going on in the ocean. That carbonate was settling down and forming a layer of sediment on the bottom. And so you can see in the sediment core, calcium carbonate made up almost 100% of the sediment in this deep core. And then something happened. You see right here, it drops to almost zero, and it stays zero for several million years. And during this excursion, when this calcium carbonate was zero, it means that there probably wasn't much calcification going on in the ocean. And this coincided with this extreme pH event. So we know that there have been times in the Earth's history when pH has reached the point to where calcification has either shut down or has been greatly reduced. And during this time, we saw big extinction events, species turnover. There were large planktonic blooms, so plankton are the plant matter that grow in the ocean. And so you think under a warmer, more carbon dioxide-rich world, the plants are going to do very well, particularly the plants in the ocean. But that's not going to be good news for the other producers and consumers in the ocean if they're getting strangled out by these large phytoplankton blooms. And I'll show you that as we go through this talk. So to answer my first question, is the sky really falling? Where are we headed? And I think we can say that at the current rate of CO2, we're increasing 10 times faster than what we saw 55 million years ago when these mass extinction events occurred. And so we are headed in a direction that potentially is going to destabilize the way the calcifiers behave in the ocean based on this proxy that we have from these records. And so the sort of first conclusion is, yes, the ocean is acidifying very rapidly. And a colleague of mine named Peter Brewer, who is at the Monterey Bay Aquarium down in Monterey, Peter's been around for a long time. He was one of the pioneers in this field. And so Peter has this great quote where he says, "The outcome is very clear that we are in uncharted territory in the entire span of Earth history. The prime cause of this is simply the rate of change. We are changing Earth far, far faster than any recorded geological event ever. That we're seeing that we have exceeded any natural phenomenon that has ever happened on the Earth." Now, if we go on to these other stressors, so we know pH, we know we're changing pH, we know it's going to have an impact, but we're also changing other things too, right? So the sister problem to ocean acidification is warming in the atmosphere, right? So we also see our models where we see changes in temperature across the globe. So this is over the next two decades from basically now into the year 2030. And the orange and yellow colors are increases in temperature. And so you can see, particularly over the northern hemisphere and the Arctic Ocean, we start to see 1 to about 1.5 degrees Celsius warming. And this is a lot of what's changing our environment up here in Alaska, right? This is why the glaciers are receding. I just spent 25 days on the Healy up in the Arctic Ocean doing a cruise in the Arctic, and we didn't see a single piece of ice. We covered 4,000 miles of Arctic Ocean, and we saw zero ice. And we went in 2005, and we did the same cruise track in 2005, and we had to break ice nearly the entire way. And we went up this year, and there were several days where I looked out my porthole, and it was blue sky and blue ocean, and I thought, wow, I could be in the Pacific Ocean somewhere, that there was no indication that we were in the Arctic. So we are seeing this change happen in really real time, even over a few years. And this is going to be nothing but get worse. We see by the middle of this century, we really start to see significant warming on the 3 to 4.5 degree range. And then by the end of this century, under our sort of worst case or even business as usual scenario, which is what we refer to as just if we keep going like we're going in terms of fossil fuel use and CO2 emissions, we're going to be hitting 7 and 8 degrees C warming up here at the North Pole, which could have catastrophic consequences for a whole number of things. The other thing that I mentioned a minute ago is deoxygenization, and that means that the warmer the water gets, the less oxygen it can hold. And so when we think of our fish and our animals that live in the ocean, they're not going to be able to sustain themselves under low oxygen conditions. And so what this plot shows is the areas of low oxygen are expanding in the ocean. We have the biggest one is down here off the coast of Mexico in what's a natural upwelling zone. But we also have some up here in the Gulf of Alaska and then stretching into the Bering Sea. And our research is also showing when we go out and we're doing these cruises, is when we see the big ocean acidification events, they're usually coupled to a low oxygen event because the same process that's driving ocean acidification is also driving low oxygen. So now we've thrown on temperature, rising temperature, and low oxygen concentrations on top of the pH change that we're already thinking about in terms of ocean acidification. So what are going to be the impacts on marine organisms? That's going to be the really important question, particularly for us up here in Alaska with our fisheries. And unfortunately, it doesn't look good. We see that, obviously, CO2 is going up, as we said, and that's causing carbonate concentrations to go down and pH to go down. The impact of that, just from a first perspective, is going to be that there's probably going to be an increase in phytoplankton. So stuff like seagrass is going to grow better in a warmer, higher CO2 world, but we don't eat a lot of seagrass, right? So there's going to be a decrease in calcification. So that's our fisheries and our calcifying fisheries, things like crabs and clams. And there's also going to be some changes in physiology, the way these animals are going to behave under these different scenarios. But then we also have other changes, as I said, to throw on top of that. Temperature going up, oxygen going down. And then we have regional stressors, things that we have a little bit more control of, things like overfishing and pollution and toxic releases into the environment. So all of these factors are coming together on sort of a global scale to impact these things that are affecting our ecosystem. And so the challenge is going to be managing these multiple stressors as we go forward. And as I said, this more CO2 and the warmer the ocean gets, there is going to be this fertilization effect where the plants are going to probably be pretty happy. So most of the phytoplankton species, a lot of the microalgae and the seagrass are going to thrive under warmer, higher CO2 conditions. But that's going to have some weird implications because one of the things we're thinking about right now is the harmful algal blooms. And so that's a big issue down here off of Southeast. When you have a red tide or you have trichodesmium, things that are blooming that can cause toxicity in the environment and in the shellfish, we see that those harmful algal blooms actually increase in their persistency and their extent under higher CO2 conditions. And we haven't figured that out completely yet, but these laboratory results show that this acid that causes people to get sick, that causes an impact from these algal events, significantly increases at higher CO2 levels. And so this is 210 parts per million, well below where we are today, 380 about where we are today, and this is what the world's going to look like at 760 parts per million, which is where we're headed by the end of this century. So you can see the significant increase in these harmful algal blooms that's going to happen under higher CO2 conditions. We also see that ocean acidification, in laboratory settings at least, has a big impact on species composition. And so this is just a schematic example of if we put a number of phytoplankton or a zooplankton or anything into a container and then expose them to increasing CO2 concentrations. And what we see is that some species are more resilient to higher CO2 levels than others. And so there's a big decrease in the amount of diversity. And so we go from a very diverse group to basically one group at higher CO2 levels. And so we think about this in terms of a stock portfolio, right? You want your stock portfolio to be as divested as possible. You want a lot of variability so that any impact in any one stock is not going to affect your overall value of your stock portfolio, right? Well, we're reducing that diversity by ocean acidification. The other thing is mutation, to where we actually change a genome type through higher CO2. So we've seen examples from the lab where a species will actually mutate into something completely different. And this is evolution, this is adaptation, this is Darwin 101, but we may not like what comes out the other end, is that there are going to be changes in these species compositions. And so what are the effects going to be? Well, in the case of coral reefs, which is really a ground zero species for ocean acidification, we don't think about them a lot up here in Alaska, but for tropical corals, OA causes a steep decline in calcification, but some species seem to be a little more robust than others. And the big news right now is the Great Barrier Reef. Have you guys seen the news about the Great Barrier Reef, that the big declines in the reef and that it's linked mainly to temperature right now, but we think that ocean acidification is going to be coming right in behind that temperature increase and really disrupting the coral growth in some of the most diverse coral environments in the world. But for us up here in Alaska, the cold water corals also have a similar response. It's at rising CO2 levels, they don't seem to be quite as tolerant, and so we do see a decline in their ability to calcify. And these are important fish habitats up here in Alaska, particularly in southeastern Alaska, and so we're really concerned about how coral reefs are going to respond. And if we look at that on a sort of a broader scale, we start thinking about impacts on different levels. Obviously, we have the people food that we're concerned about, so things like clams and oysters, but then we have to broaden that out and think about the fish food, where we see that, for instance, salmon don't really seem to be directly impacted by ocean acidification, but pink salmon in particular, about 50% of their diet is made up of pteropods, and I'm sure most of you, if you've heard me talk, or you've heard anybody talk about ocean acidification, you've heard of pteropods, where the tiny, they're kind of like snails that live in the ocean, and they make up a significant portion of the pink salmon diet, and they are a ground zero species for ocean acidification. These guys will dissolve, their shells will dissolve within one day of being exposed to these high CO2 acidic conditions, and it's not some far-off thing in the future. Our observations in the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea show that the waters today, at certain times of the year, are corrosive enough to dissolve pteropod shells. Now, we don't see pteropods actively dissolving in the environment yet, but we're not really looking at that yet. We don't even really know what the total stock of pteropods are in these regions, and so it's going to be very difficult over the next few years to really determine if there's a decline in their population. And so we need to get a better handle on that, because we do see that this is going to be a really important connection from an organism that is really vulnerable to ocean acidification to a commercially important species. And then we have to step out to the bigger ecosystems perspective. And as I said, if areas start being taken over by seagrass, if they start being taken over by microalgae, and it starts literally just drowning out the other species that are occupying those regions, this is another place where the ecosystem could be impacted. And a great, really tangible example of that has already happened. Have you guys heard about the oyster hatchery, the failures that have occurred down on the West Coast off of Oregon? There are several of the largest oyster hatcheries in the world where they actually grow up the oyster larvae, the spat, and then they export those to all the oyster farms around the world. And for four consecutive years, they had complete failure of their oyster spat. They would go out, they would have seeded up oyster larvae, they would have billions of them in these tanks. And they go out the next morning and the tanks were clean. They looked like somebody had come in and scrubbed them. There was even no residue left from these oyster larvae. And so they thought they had a problem with their system. They thought they had disease. They spent years and years trying to figure this out, and they nearly went out of business doing it until finally they got together with some scientists at the NOAA lab where I'm working now, and with some colleagues at Oregon State University, and they started monitoring the pH of the water, and they realized that they were pumping in water that was so corrosive that they were literally dissolving out their oyster larvae in their tanks. And so once we got a handle on that, we put in an early warning system where they could measure the pH of the water out in the bay before they pumped it into their hatchery, and that has allowed them to have two back-to-back years of good hatchery production. But it's still just a Band-Aid, because the longer and longer we go, the longer period of time the water will be corrosive to the point to where they can't pump it in, and they can only recirculate for so long. So while this is a fix, at least on the short-term basis, it's not going to last very long. And so we're already thinking about other ways of helping those guys through. And I know that hatcheries are becoming a bigger issue down here in Southeast. I've talked to several groups that are talking about expanding and investing new resources into the oyster farm industry down here. And they're really concerned about this process, because these same waters that are doing this off the West Coast are also present up here in the Gulf of Alaska. And so sort of the second take-home message that I have for you is that it's a lot more complicated than we really first thought, is that there seems to be a variety of responses to ocean acidification, but we do know that it's not happening in a vacuum. So these same organisms that are going to be negatively impacted by reduced pH are also going to be facing the challenges of warmer temperatures and lower oxygen, and that's going to impact multiple life stages. Organisms are going to have to adjust the way that they deal with those things, and we may see some adaptation capability in some of these species, but it's not guaranteed. And again, because it's happening on a time scale that is so short relative to the natural evolutionary process, that we're just really worried about the ecosystems being able to catch up. And so I've put together three little schematics here for you to sort of describe the different scenarios that these stresses that these organisms are feeling. And so the first one is a pulse stress, where this would just be time across the bottom, and then this is the degree of stress over here on this axis. And so something like a storm event, you'd be coming along under normal conditions, and then you would get this major event, and then it would come back down to normal, something that happened one time and then went away. Another press disturbance is where we start out at some normal condition, and then it goes up, it ramps up, and then stays at that new level. And this is what we think of something like overfishing, where we're going in and we're over-harvesting a region consistently. And then finally, the most disturbing one we think about in terms of the stressors of the ecosystem is this ramp scenario. And this is where ocean acidification and warming comes into effect, where we have these constant step functions. We may stay static for a few years, but then we have a big jump to some new stress level that then stays normal for a few years, and then it jumps again, but the overall trend is always going up. And these thresholds that we're passing here, we have no idea how the ecosystems are going to respond to them, because the time period that it stays constant may not be enough to let the organisms, to let the animals find some new equilibrium that they can exist at before they're thrown another loop. And so the message of that is really expect change. I think we're confident in saying now that between ocean acidification and the other stressors that we're going to be feeling in the ocean, there are going to be changes in the marine ecosystem. And we do have some real-world proxies to look at what that's going to mean. And so what we've done here is we looked at how coral reefs, there are natural environments in the ocean where carbon dioxide bubbles out of the rocks. And so there's a big one off the southern coast of Italy, and then we have one out in the Aleutian Islands where it's a natural CO2 seep. And so the CO2 bubbles up from the rock, dissolves into the ocean, and it lowers the pH. And so what I've done is taken three pictures for you here and showed you what a healthy coral reef looks like. This is in the ocean at a pH level about 8.05 where we are today. And then we went to one of the boundaries of one of these carbon dioxide natural seeps. And you can kind of see in the background, you can see the bubbles, but this picture was taken just enough out of that zone so that the pH was about 7.95, or where we'll be in about 50 years or about 40 years from now. And so you can already see the loss of diversity between these two pictures, dropping just 0.1 pH units from here to here. And then finally, the last picture we took right in the middle of one of these carbon dioxide seeps, where pH is 7.8, where we'll be in the year 2100. And you can see it's nothing but rock. There is no coral reef. There is no diversity. This is a pretty bleak environment. And so we'll see. I think this provides a really realistic proxy as to where we're headed as carbon dioxide levels continue to accumulate and as pH continues to drop. And so what are the effects going to be on the fishery specifically? The jury is still largely out on that. We've got a lot of research going on up and down the coast all across the world to figure out how not only the calcifying organisms, the crabs and the clams, are going to respond, but also how the finfish are going to respond. And another colleague of mine has a great quote, and she says that we're still going to have fisheries if we don't mind willing to eat different fisheries, that we do think that there is going to be a tangible change, and there's probably going to be a net loss in the biodiversity of the fisheries that we have in our ocean one way or the other. And so we kind of sum this up. I'm going to take this back to something that we can all appreciate, and not to pick on any smokers that we have in the room, but ocean acidification is a lot like smoking, where the root cause of a health problem that you're having is smoking, but it leads to other things like high blood pressure, emphysema, cancer, and the only way to make those go away is to stop smoking, right? But in the meantime, you can treat those other symptoms that you're having. And so that's what I think we're going to have to do with ocean acidification is in the next 20 years, probably in the next 50 years, it's going to be very, very hard to get as a human global population to get our arms around big reductions in carbon dioxide. We've got economics working against us. We've got population working against us. There are a whole lot of things that are going to make it very difficult to ramp down carbon dioxide emissions in my lifetime. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try and that we shouldn't work to that effort, but we'd also keep in mind that we've got to come up with solutions to treating the symptoms that we're starting to see because of these stressors that we're having in the ocean. And obviously, as I've said throughout the talk, the three big ones that we're going to have to think of are ocean acidification, warming, and deoxygenization. We're going to have to think about solutions that are going to help the ecosystems and the organisms that are going to be impacted by these stressors better manage their way through it. And we can do that in a number of different ways. Things like reducing the amount of runoff that's coming off of croplands and fields. It's introducing fertilizer, excess amounts of fertilizer into the ocean. This is what leads to the dead zones that we see. Things like upwelling. If we can get a handle on temperature increases and reduce the amount of upwelling that's happening, we can slowly start to think about how to manage our way through a challenge that's really going to be at the forefront of ocean policy over the next 100 years at least. And so just to summarize, I'm running out of time, but we do know that a major catastrophic event is coming. Between ocean acidification and the other stressors that are impacting the ocean, we're pretty confident now that we are going to see a significant net loss of biodiversity. In fact, we're already seeing losses of biodiversity in the ocean. And the unfortunate thing is we know how to prevent it. Carbon dioxide is basically driving it all. So if we could just simply reduce our carbon dioxide output, we could certainly start to reverse this course that we're on. We cannot yet predict what the exact cost, the casualties, or the damages are going to be from these phenomena, but we know that they're not going to be good. And my research group up in Fairbanks right now is working on specifically an economic evaluation for Alaska to try to get our arms around what the next sort of 10 to 20 years is going to look like for the Alaska fisheries, and trying to put a value on that on a community-by-community basis, and so that we can come to the different places and talk about how much this could potentially impact the economy of the different regions. And that the uncertainties, and I do recognize that we have a lot of uncertainties, but that's not an excuse for inaction. We have to invest. We have to start thinking about what we are going to do to get ahead of this problem. And we are making progress. From a national perspective, a lot of the federal agencies, the National Science Foundation, NOAA, even NASA and the USGS, agencies you wouldn't traditionally think of, are starting to put money into ocean acidification research. Our more local organizations like the North Pacific Research Board is making ocean acidification a priority. And we had a big win last year, and it was thanks to the help of several people in this room. We asked the state of Alaska to directly fund an ocean acidification initiative to build a monitoring network in Alaska that will allow us to track in real time how the different ecosystem variables are changing around the state. And with the help of a number of organizations around the state, the legislature recognized that as important and funded our full request for that. And so starting in March of 2013, we're gearing up for it right now. We're going to begin deploying these big surface buoys that are going to be able to monitor pH and CO2, nutrients, temperature, all in real time, and that's going to be sent back to us via satellite, and we're going to be able to post that up on our websites and be able to share that with the stakeholders and the community participants around Alaska to hopefully get a better idea of how we're going to manage these problems and think about these problems in the future. So with that, I'll take any questions that you have.